Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, an independent, family-owned digital and print-on-demand publisher of books we want to see in the world. If you'd like to support Witchlit and Thousand Volt Press, buy our books. Our most recent title is Pagan Roots, Reclaiming Concepts of the Sacred by Yvonne A. Burrow. Other titles include A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, Changing Paths, also by Yvonne A. Burrow, and my most recent novel, Verona Green, A Story of Art and Magic. Head over to thousandvoltpress.com/store or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast, and all that will be linked in the show notes. But we also appreciate that listening, subscribing, and leaving a rating also really supports the show, so thank you for those. Next month, I'll be reading and discussing Charles Godfrey Leland's Aradia, The Gospel of the Witches, with author Aidan Wachter. Aradia was published in 1899 and is in the public domain, so there are myriad ways of finding a copy if you'd like to read it before our discussion. But for now, let's jump into our episode with Via Hedera. Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Hi, welcome to May's Witchlit. Today we're going to talk about the children's book Touch Blue, Signs and Spells, Love Charms and Chants, Auguries and Old Beliefs in Rhyme, which was written in 1958 by Lillian Morrison. For those of you who haven't read or heard of this book, I have a little bit about the book and a little bit about the author that I'll read you now, and then I will let our guest introduce herself. And I had not heard about this book or this author either, so this was new to me. So Lillian Morrison was a noted librarian, poet, and anthologist. As a coordinator of young adult services at the New York Public Library, Morrison collected rhymes and chants from her young patrons that she later compiled into anthologies, including Yours Till Niagara Falls, which was published in 1950. Morrison also edited a collection of folk sayings, I Scream, You Scream, A Feast of Food Rhymes, which was published in 1997. That book, a school library journal reviewer wrote, has the tone of something that really is for kids. You all know the magic of a good loud chant. Put a copy on your shelf, then put your ear to the window at recess and see if you don't hear some of these short verses rising up from the chaos of the schoolyard. Lillian Morrison's contributions to the world of children's literature and librarianship were many, said Ellen Ruffin, curator of the DeGrumman Collection at University of Southern Mississippi, where Morrison's papers are housed. Lillian Morrison was born on October 27, 1917, in Jersey City. She said of her early life, "Mine was a city childhood, and our playground was the street. We jumped rope, roller skated, played almost every kind of ball game, stoop ball, stick ball," she said in an interview. She graduated from high school in the mid-1930s and used scholarships and money earned from working as a waitress to put herself through Douglas College at Rutgers. After earning a BA in mathematics, she enrolled at the Columbia University School of Library Service, where she earned a graduate degree in 1942. She told Hopkins that she knew she was in heaven when she left her job in the statistical department of Baumburgers, a large department store in Newark, New Jersey, for a job as a filer at New York Public Library. "I was surrounded by books. The whole world opened up to me." Morrison died on Monday, January 27th, 2014, at the age of 96. And that is from the obituary written by Rocco Staino for the School Library Journal. And a little bit about the book. This is from the preface, and this is written by Morrison. "It is to the sense of play so strong in children that the charms, formulas, cures, and rhymed superstitions in this collection are meant to appeal. They're not to be taken too seriously or too literally, but because of their immeasurable age and the vitally human uses to which they have been put through the centuries, these old rhymes and sayings also appeal to something deeper in us, to a sense of the living past, to a sense of mystery and magic, to a sense of poetry. They are meant to amuse and entertain. If, at the same time, they can, through sound, meaning, or the ancient aura surrounding them, stir the feelings or kindle the imagination of children, or people of any age, so much the better." So to talk about this book and the person who chose this book with me this month is Via Hedera, and I'm going to let her introduce herself and tell you about her work.
Great to be here, and thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you back.
Thanks for inviting me back. For those of you who have not met me before, I'm Via Hedera. I am a author, occultist, folklore enthusiast, traditional North American folk witch, and the author of Folkloric American Witchcraft and the Multicultural Experience. I chose this book. Wait, am I supposed to go into that yet?
You can. That's the first thing I was going to ask you, but you can definitely go into that. So yeah, book?
And we can edit all this part out, right?
Yes, editing is a thing.
Okay. I guess I should go into my background a little bit. So I write specifically on North American folk witchcraft and the preservation of multicultural charms, magic, and practices as they get transmitted throughout North America and the Americas at large in the world. My goal as an author and as a researcher, and in some ways as just folk witch, is to unite people and their beliefs and find the common connective grounds and intersections that exist between cultures, religions, people, and magic. And I'm a firm believer that the one most universal spiritual concept that we have is this fear, wonder, and belief in magic and the people who practice them. And as someone who is a practitioner of occultism, witchcraft, and magic itself, I feel like this connectivity is vital, and it's passed on through our children, and it connects our cultures, it bonds us. We have shared fears of spirits, of ghosts, of fairies, of goblins, of ghouls, and of course, of witches. The powerful, the seductive, the beautiful. And I chose this book because of exactly what she put in the preface. I felt such a connection because this is how magic is transmitted on a folk magic level, on a folk level. This is how magic gets transmitted, is through simple childhood interactions that you just hold on to, that you latch on to. It's these little counting out rhymes, these charms, these little beliefs, they wind up so ingrained into our beliefs and into our everyday lives that they transmit over centuries and they connect us. And things that we didn't have in common, we suddenly have in common because we all know simple things like mirror, mirror, or he loves me not, or these very simple charms that, in the Western world at least, are highly connective. And the fact that they touch that innocent part of our childhood and the magic and the wonder that still exists within us before the real world catches up and slaps us in the face with reality, it's a really beautiful thing. And I think it's a really connective thing. So that's why I chose Touch Blue.
Yeah. So did you know much about Morrison's work?
Not
as a gotcha, because I'd never heard of her.
No, I had never read the bio. I had picked up this book while I was doing research for mine. I had had it, you know, in the back of my grandma's shelf. And I just, you know, I didn't really look at it because I didn't see what the point was. It was something that was just like along with the Mother Goose stuff that I didn't quite, that wasn't the kind of folk magic I was looking into. And then I opened the book finally and realized this is a compendium of a lot of the folk magic and charms that I wrote about. A lot of the things that I sourced from older materials, she had compiled into this book of wonder that was actually, she's right in her preface in that it touches more than just, you know, the part of us that's a child, and it's not just for children. It's for witches, too. Mm-hmm. It's some of our most basic common practices that we post about, that we write about, that we study in this very simplified, very in some ways, very secular kind of form. And I had no idea that what kind of life she had led. And I love the fact that she had wound up becoming a librarian and that she left statistics. There's as someone who works in the higher ed finance sector, she's living. That's the dream, is to leave the math and go somewhere into a library. But no, I had no idea. And I love knowing that about her. We clearly have a lot in common.
Yeah. And just to think, I mean, I was thinking about, like, she wrote one of her first books in 1950 and she was still publishing in 1997.
That is prolific.
Like, she had a long, very productive life. And clearly, she also wrote, and I meant to include it in the thing, but she wrote this book called Breakdancing Kids in the 80s, which was about, you know, kids in New York where she worked. And she performed it at like a school journal conference with kids breakdancing as she read the poem.
No way.
Yeah. And I was like, woman was like plugged into kids like her whole life. Like, she wasn't stuck in 1950 or 1917 when she was born. Like, she was plugged into kids her whole life. So
that's pretty incredible. And it makes sense that she would wind up writing on folklore. She clearly has this bond with the community. Like, this is somebody who definitely like was representing the zeitgeist as it was and writing about, you know, urban culture. So the fact that she would recognize the magic that exists within just basic everyday urban life, that includes the magic of dance. Pretty awesome. She's fascinating.
Yeah. It was a nice little rabbit hole to go down looking at her. And I will say, for anybody who does research on folklore, the bibliography in this book is awesome.
Yep.
It is several pages long. It's a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff that I've looked at for my own research, and a lot of stuff I didn't know about. So like, it was great to just kind of like, oh, the things you find, like you said, in unexpected places.
Absolutely. I combed through that bibliography. It was so helpful to cross-reference, and using her bibliography to do so. And I was able to collect, you know, some of the stuff in here, like the apple charms she mentioned. I'd already had so much info, but it was just so nice to go through her bibliography to find sources that I had never known and be able to back up the information that I was using. I love a big, juicy bibliography.
Yeah, no kidding, man. Yeah, it was funny because nothing is annotated in the book because it's for kids, right? So there's no like citations or anything. It made me think I've spent a lot of time with Donald Watts and his Dictionary of Plant Lore, and like so many similar sources he does because of what he's doing. They're like cited in the text, and you can just go look and at his bibliography, which is a fat, juicy bibliography too. But I was just like, it's just funny to me to think about, you know, writing this in the 50s for kids. You know, this is like before satanic panic garbage and all of this stuff. And I was just like, I really appreciated that it is very much like that, like the magic of childhood, like kind of what she talks about, like this thing that I think a lot of us lose as we grow up is that ability to just go, yeah, I can say this little charm and this thing will happen. Or I can put a frozen spoon under my pillow and I'll have a snow day tomorrow, or, you know, whatever. And I just really appreciated that she apparently kept that herself, at least an interest in it, but also kind of had that eye that, oh, you know, adults might read this too.
I love regain that.
A little bit of that.
I love that. We lose so much of the connection and that safety and that feeling that magic, the magic of your childhood gives you. I love that she stayed connected to it. I feel like there's something that gets lost in translation when you grow up. And it's weird to come circle back as a witch and, you know, sort of look at these rhymes that were silly and just stuff I was doing on the schoolyard, circling back now 30 years later. At 37 and being like, oh snap, I'm doing these are like everyday things I'm doing to celebrate the Sabbath. It's so interesting how much your childhood just circles back to be a comforting place, and that's what I feel like these charms sort of represent, is this comfort. And I love that there is an era, I feel like there's this era, you're right, before the satanic panic, there was this era in which Ouija boards were just a party game, a fun party game that everybody was doing. And it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't, you're going to hell, church is preaching about it. And this book sort of touches in a way on acceptable magic, mm-hmm. by making it seem like nothing more than childhood fancy, when these are based on old folks' charms. Many of them are just old spells that have been brought over from Europe and different countries that for many people are legitimate ways of practicing love fortunes or apotropaia or spirit keeping or any kind of things that are found in this book. And I love that there's this era in which the magic was acceptable. It was a little bit silly. If it was a part of your life, it was no big deal. And this book sort of reflects that innocent love and acceptability of magic as a part of everyday life, even if you don't take it seriously. She saw clearly in her preface, like a very positive aspect of what this brings to the world. And then satanic panic hit, and then, you know, Hasbro sales for Ouija boards crash, and you got The Exorcist, and now all these little counting out rhymes, you suddenly go to church and you're getting told that, you know, this is the devil's work. And in, you know, the era she's writing this was nothing more than simple childhood skipping games at that point. So it's an interesting kind of look at history in this time where magic still had innocence before it became, you know, the bastion of evil and any kind of practice of magic, you know, you're going to hear about it. And superstition took on such a more negative tone when in some ways superstition shouldn't be seen as entirely negative. There's a part of it that's just the preservation of information and safety and connectivity between people's cultures and families. And I sometimes get really sad thinking about how much we grew up, especially in my childhood, with this satanic panic and the disillusionment of magic as a child, and how you're told not to practice it and not to do these things because it's evil. And now we're circling back. And so it's kind of nice to reclaim some of the charms in these books, in this book is my own.
No, exactly. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about how The Exorcist played into the satanic panic, but oh, you're 100% right.
Oh, definitely. I mean, before then, there wasn't you don't see the Ouija board and getting used as much in movies as just an ultimate source of demonic energy coming into your life. It would be used in movies as a spooky sideshow thing that the Roma woman would be reading in these like terrible old 50s movies.
Yeah.
And it was same with crystal balls or tarot cards. It was a game you could buy that was very easy. Then Exorcist came out, and suddenly something that was a party game became a portal to opening specifically to a hell dimension of demons from the Christian mythology.
Yeah.
And then suddenly those Hasbro sales start to slip. The Ouija board becomes pulled from shelves because it's now associated with demonic evil. And a simple game you could buy, much like tarot cards, which were also just a game, become a huge no-no in a lot of households.
Yeah. It was funny you were saying that because I was thinking about, there's this movie that used to be like one of my favorite like spooky but not gory movies when I was a kid or a teenager. I think it was George C. Scott, and it called The Changeling.
Ooh.
And he moves into this house that is haunted, and he's trying to figure it out. And they bring this woman in who does automatic writing. And that was the first time I'd ever seen automatic writing. So my association with automatic writing was this like haunting, spooky thing. And then when I started looking into spiritualism, I was like, oh, it was not even remotely spooky. It's like a totally different thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely progressing in kind of this Hollywood image of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up around a lot of Baptists and Lutherans, so Ouija boards were an absolute, you don't even talk about that. And everyone has a funny story about, well, I knew a guy who knew a guy whose grandma this happened to. And it's like, I love how this meme gets passed through generations of, well, no, I totally saw the demon come out. I saw it. We make up these mythologies and give them power. And that's sort of how all these charms in this book got their power and are still preserving to this day, is we have invested so much power into things like, say, the meaning of flowers, their value, their inherent essence, their quintessence that permeates the life, that to this day, every year, we grow, buy, and sell a bunch of roses to demonstrate love. It is just a very Western culture kind of, this is mm-hmm. the flavor, this is what it means. And when I give it, I am trading synergy with this person. Like, we've invested so much into things that even in the simplest forms, like little folk charms, giving flowers, putting them in your shoe, keeping rose petals on the bed to draw love, they become just intrinsic, just part of the way you live, the way we live, and the way we communicate with each other. I love that we put so much faith into things that we actually form a language like that of flowers.
Yeah. It's funny. When you said language of flowers, I was thinking about like roses are like the most cliche
right.
kind of thing. And I was like, they're so like, especially like in the like books actually published during the Victorian era about the language of flowers, like there's so much nuance. You know, like if you send lilacs, you're breaking off the engagement, you know, like these
yes.
things that we would never think about now. Or actually, I've been researching juniper, and like including a sprig of juniper was like this protection, like, you know, I want to protect you or envelop you, like kind of thing. And I was like, that's way more interesting than roses.
Yeah, I always thought, you know, if you're going to give me a flower, I want one that's going to be like, I like Valentine's gifts and the plant love and plant exchange that has to do with something that's going to be very useful to me. I'm going to want apples. I'm going to want something that I can turn into something. Yeah. I was like, around roses. I don't even like rose jelly. I don't like a lot of rose flavored stuff.
Yeah, it goes to soap really fast. Yeah.
Which was nice in this book. They have so many other plants referenced other than roses.
Yeah. I feel like this is like, if you wanted to scratch the surface of folklore, this would be like a great place to start and then kind of dive in from there. So were there ones in here that you had never heard or that you particularly liked?
Yes. I love whenever I see references. I mean, love magic is it. That is my favorite thing. Love fortunes, especially North American folklore, because it's so collective and it's containing love charms from all over the world. I loved the ones that I found in here. Some of them, you know, I'd seen a lot of yarrow charms before, but I'd never seen this specific one. Good night, fair yarrow, thrice good night to thee. I hope before tomorrow's dawn, my true love I shall see. I love finding these really cute ones to add to, like, you know, my repertoire of incantations. Specifically just going through some of these love charms. They were a little bit familiar. Most of them were pretty familiar, but it was just so nice to sort of see them all sourced in one place and learn rhymes that I had never heard. Incantations had never been like a strong thing that I studied. I was more into the history and the background behind the concept. Mm-hmm. So kind of like putting these into my working book and trying them out has been like a lot of fun. It's definitely my favorite part. I had never heard of the bird augury section before. Mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with rabbit augury, especially, you know, Roman rabbit augury. But I had never heard of love magic containing like bird augury, especially related to Valentine's. And avian magic, everything related, a lot of animal magic, I'm just very unfamiliar with. So the counting out spells with the birds was definitely new for me. Definitely a highlight, because it's just, I feel like it's a magic we don't use anymore. We turn to a lot of new kinds of divinations, or we use divination in a way that's, you know, very standard. It's easy to get. We can buy our sets on Etsy. But to learn a divination that's just very natural and based on what you see, it's kind of fun to play around with that. So I think that was kind of the most unfamiliar thing I had found when I first picked up the book, was the idea of bird augury, which I just hadn't really touched on before.
Yeah. You know, there's like a thing, and I think Chaucer writes about it, about like the Feast of Fowls around Valentine's Day. And that's when birds choose their mates, is on Valentine's Day. And we think that maybe that's why we celebrate Valentine's Day as this love holiday. It was associated with that. So
that would make a lot of sense.
But I didn't know about, like, if you see a bird, this will, like, you know, presage what your spouse will be, like their job. Which, right. Oh, it's funny.
And I would love to know where that came from. Like, yeah, how did it develop? Like did, what happened to that with that bird in history where they were like, that's the one, that's the divorce bird.
Yeah, really. Or like, you know, I think crows are lucky, but a lot of people don't. Like, and how much of that is personal? Like, and the other one in that chapter specifically that I didn't know, I knew some of the like Taylor Tinker Soldier Spy things for the petal counting, but there were ones in there I'd never heard before.
Oh, some of them are a little, I had never heard some of these rhymes before. So I was thinking, you know, I wonder what this looks like all over the world, what rhymes look like all over the world. Cause some of these are just like, I feel like I should have heard them growing up here in the States, but some of them are completely foreign. Like I didn't really grow up with the snail, snail, put out your horns. Mm-hmm. That's something that I adopted into my practice while I've been, you know, circumnavigating my relationship with snails as a witch. And since they're an animal that I work very closely with, and also a colony that I keep in my house, I've always really loved snails. And I had never really grew up with snail charms and snail counting. And the more I researched folklore, the more I found that that was very, very common and definitely a transplant from England, Scotland, Ireland, this snail charm lore.
Do you want to talk about what that is? Because if people haven't read the book, they may not know.
Oh, yes. So there's a counting charm specifically that asks the snail to show its eyes or horns. It's asking a snail to come out of its shell. And if it does so, it would indicate that your love loves you. It's sort of, snails also appear in another charm called the Lubberkin charm, where snails on May Day, which is woohoo coming up, as a love charm, you will put live snails on a sheet of cornmeal and shove that under your bed. And when you wake up, it'll show the initials of the person you're to marry or have a relationship with. Which makes sense. As a snail owner, I can tell you, they really love cornmeal. They will just have so much fun, but it's not nice to just leave them in a pan of it. You're supposed to give them a teaspoon. Yeah, snails have this association with sex, love, because they can be pretty prolific when they breed, because they are hermaphroditic and they can breed in fascinating ways. They have some of them have what's called a love spear or love dart, which is how they mate. It's gross.
Yeah.
but they're widely associated with love and fortune telling, and they appear in this book. And snails are just not something I wouldn't think of them as like a very sexy, sexual animal, but it's a very common animal referenced in these old folk charms.
Yeah. Because I've been doing so much research, like a lot of stuff is jumbled in my head. Is this the one, is it in this book where it talks about if the snail points at a tree with its horns? Is that in this book?
Not in this book, but I love that. Where'd you hear that?
Oh, I'll have to look. I'll have to get back to you on that one. But it was basically like asking the question about love. And if my love loves me, when you point your horns, you'll point to a tree.
Oh, that's cute.
And then I was thinking, I wonder if there's more to that, because trees have so much, you know, symbolism behind them. Like, does it matter what kind of tree the snail points to?
And I would imagine if it's pointing towards a tree, the theme would be growth. The theme would be that love is growing, very basic phallic imagery.
Yeah. Or if it, would it matter if it pointed to an oak tree or an elder, you know, like, right. What would that mean? You know, like.
Yeah. According to tree lore, what if it's pointing towards a dead tree? Would that matter?
Ooh,
would
that change? Yeah. That's probably the widow, the widow tree.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is these exact same snail charms that you see, they're very similar to mole charms. I think they're kind of used interchangeably. It will say, snails, snails, stick out your horns, and I will give you barley corns. And with the mole, it's mole, mole, come out of your hole, or I will beat you black as coal, or mole, mole, you know, come out of your hill. It's for the same reason with moles, it's a love charm. It's a show me your face, like come just be summoned, and that will provide me with the assurance I need to know that I'm going to get married someday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what the link in that was with people in history where they were like, if I see this snail or if I see this mole, I'm totally getting married. I always wondered what that link possibly could be.
Yeah. Well, and because I've come across so much of that kind of like, who will my mate be? Will I marry? When will I marry? You know, it's like, you know, think about it from like the perspective of women, you know, even in early 20th century and back, like it was so important, like who you married, because that was going to determine what your life was like.
Oh, yeah. Which
so
makes that
it was critical.
Make a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was critical information to have, right? So it makes sense to me that it was so important. It's like everything cures warts. It's like everything becomes like, who am I going to marry? Like, because it was just everybody had warts and everybody wanted to know who their spouse was going to be.
And it is very specifically associated with young girls counting charms for love. And especially I've noticed that too, that a lot of them are geared towards, tell me what he's going to do though. Like when I marry this person, what's their job? So when we do divination with wax or with molten lead, they're not looking for initials. They want to know, they want to see a broom. You want to see a cup. You want to see a crown. A lot of the charms I found that are counting out have to do with that too. Or it'll count out 1, 2, 3, he'll be good to me. 2, 3, 4, you know, he'll do this job. And it's an interesting glimpse into history and like this desperation to know this critical thing that a woman at that time that's all they were offering you is, this is your life, is figuring out who you're going to marry and how many babies you'll have. And, you know, that sort of like oppression of femininity is sort of also a part of these folk charms.
Yeah, there was one in this book about, like, if you have one, you can get up and run, like, about how many children you have.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's kind of dark.
Yes. Like, it's in some ways, I think these were intended to be prescriptions. These rhymes existed as devices to help teach young girls what to look for, what to avoid, and to give advice. However completely misguided it may have been at the time, I can't imagine how many little charms we have where it started off as just a mother trying to give advice to a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
He does this, do that, you know, for a logic gate for a daughter to follow through life for a safe and happy marriage and birth. And it's, you know, slowly to teach a child, you'll simplify it. You'll turn it into a rhyme. And then that rhyme gets passed how we transmit information that to us right now seems innocuous, but maybe back then had a lot deeper meaning and a lot more value.
Yeah.
I, for one, am glad I don't have to use bird augury to choose my partners.
Well, I was thinking, so that what another like rabbit hole I've gone down recently is like saints and like the kind of auguries around saints, right? Or divination on saints' days. And like a lot of those too, like especially martyred virgin saints are love saints. And I'm like, this is really messed up.
Right, like
Saint Agnes and Saint Catherine. I mean, brutally murdered, and then they're who you go to find out who your husband's going to be.
Right, you stick a pin in your sleeve on Saint Agnes Day, or you break eggs on the eve of Saint Agnes Day. I always wondered why that is. Is it to represent all the unrealized potential of love that these martyrs never got to have?
I don't know. I mean, Catherine is seen as protective of women and young girls. So maybe there's a hope that she will bring you a good husband, perhaps.
That's true. I don't know a lot about saints. How about Agnes?
Yeah, Agnes, is it? Agnes is pretty brutally murdered too, I think.
Oh, God.
She was either, they've kind of all run together in my brain, which is bad. I didn't prep notes. I shouldn't have prepped notes. But Agnes, her father wants to marry her off to a pagan, basically. And she says no because she's already given herself to God, and they take her to a brothel, and like the guy who she's supposed to be betrothed to tries to have his way with her, and he either dies or catches fire. Like they strip her naked and like her hair grows to cover her nakedness.
You know,
like it's a whole series of events, and eventually they either burn her alive or cut her head off, which seems to be the general way those things go. Because they survive multiple tortures, and then they have to cut their head off because they can't kill them any other way, which in its own way is kind of a weird, like, you have to cut its head off kind of thing. It's real strange to me that saints would be the ones to go to figure these things out. But
it's interesting how much there's always a dark side to love.
Yeah, and most of these saints wanted to marry them off to somebody, and they're like, no, I'm already, because Catherine is the same thing, like, she bested all of these pagan philosophers and converted them all to Christianity. And then Maxentius decides he's killed his wife already because she converted her to Christianity. So he had her killed. So now he's going to marry Catherine, and she's like, no. And so then he decides to pull her apart with these wheels, Catherine wheels.
Yeah.
And she touches it, and it's struck by lightning and bursts into flame, which is why we have fireworks called Catherine's Wheels.
No way.
Yeah. So, it's and Catherine is largely probably completely made up saint, and her story is a lot like Hypatia. Like, probably her story is based on Hypatia because she's also Catherine of Alexandria.
Oh.
So, there's a lot of weirdness there.
I love that link. God, I wish pagans could get canonized sometime, because Hypatia is just such a fascinating and inspiring idea and concept. But God, talk about brutal deaths. No one wants to get bludgeoned to death with tiles.
That's not fun. No, I mean, I kind of see Hypatia as a pagan saint anyway. And I think I've heard this from other people, this is not an original thought, but like the saints really belong to everybody, because Christianity was forced on people, sometimes literally at sword point. So if they're going to force it on us for 2 millennia, we can use whatever we want from it. So
And, you know,
so the saints belong to everybody.
I would argue she's got saint-like qualities in the fact that, you know, she taught Christian and pagan alike. Mm-hmm. She stood in those forums and taught anyone who came by, regardless of class or gender or age or whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
If that's not some Christ-like compassion and love, then I don't know what is.
Well, and the fact that she was killed by Christians probably has less to do with the fact that she was a pagan and more to do with, like, political intrigue going on in Alexandria. Yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely she should have. It sucks who you choose to keep company with.
Yeah, which is a little far afield from this book, but it does all tie together. It does all tie together, I think.
Yes.
So I'm curious, like, because you talked about coming across this book when you were doing your research. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was like how this stuff has played both into your writing, I guess, and your practice. And you've talked a little bit about that, but I guess kind of maybe talk more about the writing aspect of it. Like how do you approach that kind of research and like weaving that into what you're working on?
My approach is connectivity. I use this information specifically to try to find connections that exist in different cultures. I want to know why we would transmit this. Why is this so popular throughout the Americas? So when I was, you know, when I started my research and I was going through these books, it was just the innocence and the simplicity that really drew me in. And I realized that makes this a lot more transmittable. This is a lot more communicative. If I can show people that there is a universality here going on between the kind of magic we're doing and the things we believe in, the practices that we're continuing with, and the things we're trying to, or witches in my case, I think a lot of folk witches and traditional witches, you could say we're Reconstructionists. We're a part of that umbrella of practitioner where we're trying to revive and work from sources that already existed. There's space for universal and verified, you know, personal gnosis, however you choose to put that. There's space for that. And that's, you know, within the practice of the individual practitioner. But then there's these universal qualities that help us communicate practices to each other and give us a basis, a structure, a context. And that's what I love about love and folk charms. They're easy. They're accessible. They're secular for the most part. And when they're not secular, it doesn't really matter because in a lot of these religions, you shouldn't even be practicing magic in the first place.
Right.
You know, you shouldn't be mixing saints with magic in the first place. However, those of us who grew up with Santeria or with hoodoo or voodoo all know that that's just how it is. Magic is there. It was there from the beginning. It never was completely extricated. There is always a magic aspect to every Abrahamic religion. And so when I see the universal appeal of these charms, I want to put that into my writing. And a lot of what I did put into folkloric American witchcraft, especially in my keys section where I go through and I go, you know, this is in the South, you'll find these egg charms. Or where do you find keys? You find them in these regions. Where do you find heart-shaped herb folklore? In these regions. And these books, a book like Touch Blue really helps you understand just how common it was. And going through the bibliography helps me understand where she got her information from. Then I can find out where that author was living. Were they just copying their work from Puckett and from Wayland Hand and from the Frank C. Brown collection, which is where you find a lot of these preserved? Was it all copied from the Journal of American Folklore? It really helps to give that context for those of us who are trying to reconstruct, you know, these practices with context. So I think for my writing, it's really necessary to find the little itty bitty pieces that people can recognize: apple charms, clovers, birds, snails, and then take that so I can expand on it. Where did it come from? What different cultures see it this way? How did that happen here in the different regions? If you go in the Northeast, how do they feel about owls and love spells? Is it the same in the South? It opens a lot of questions just by these little tiny itty bitty sayings like rain on a Monday, sunshine on Sunday. Now I'm going to go down a rabbit hole of weekday occultism, sailing folklore, maritime everything, all because of these tiny little rhymes. So I think that's how it's really impacted me, is I think in every way I need these little charms to exist so that I know where the bigger ideas came from or went to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is so true. And I was thinking just like one of the things I think that happens, and you touch on this so well with American folklore, like especially like those collections, like the Wayland Hand collections and the even the Ozark name is
Randolph.
Thank you, Randolph and Hyatt, like yeah. Like Hyatt's Adams County one. Like if you start going through those, you can almost like peel them off. Like, oh, that's a German one. That's a Swedish one. That's an English one. That's French. And it's like, yes, in the United States, they're all just swirled together in this bundle. And like, I always think about just coming from the South, like how much Southern folklore practiced by white Southerners really comes from enslaved people and from Africa originally, like, you know, eating Hoppin' John or, you know, collards and pig on New Year's Day, that came from enslaved people. That wasn't something white people came up with on their own, but it's all mixed together in this pot. And I think it's interesting, like you said, to see, to go back and see where these things really originated and how they've transmuted through time.
Because they are part of our regional culture now. Mm-hmm. This is just part of who we all are now. So there's aspects of our practices, especially I can imagine living in the South, there are aspects of your practice that are going to be distinctly Afro-American, distinctly Indigenous American, distinctly European, with some Chinese thrown in, some mm-hmm. Filipino. I know, especially up here in the Northwest, it's just so the folk magic that's been introduced here includes a lot of people from East Asia. So mm-hmm. now when Lunar New Year comes around, it's just very normal to have red lanterns. It's mm-hmm. just completely like, well, yeah, that's just part of the magic. It's good luck.
Setting our pyramids of mandarins in the grocery store when you walk in. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you know, bringing them over to a neighbor mm-hmm. and being like, oh yeah, well, I Lunar New Year, woo, you know, yeah. decorating the house in snakes. And, you know, it's just so participatory, and it's a huge part of Seattle culture, because we are such a amalgam culture out here, and we're, you know, distinctly high population of East Asian. Mm-hmm. And I live about 2 miles from the I district, the international district, which includes Chinatown, Little Saigon, Little Korea, Little Japan. And it's like the most incredible place to be, because the cultures have spread out everywhere. So now Lunar New Year is everywhere. It's at the colleges. It's at the schools. It's just part of living here and being with other Americans. And everyone is American. Anyone can be an American. That's what makes it so fun, is anybody. You could be anybody. Anybody you see could be at any moment. Yeah. Or at least it used to be that way before, you know, stuff got weird recently.
Yeah.
but back in the good old days.
Yeah. Let's say, like, because I'm in San Jose, we also have a large, like, well, we have a lot of South Asian and East Asian population. And I live in a neighborhood that was traditionally the kind of Latin quarter of San Jose. And so when I go for my walk around the neighborhood, there's a few houses down from me, and they have a statue of the Virgin and Child in their yard. And they also had red lanterns for Lunar New Year. And I was just like, this is like you said, that's what it means to be American right there. Like that was the perfect encapsulation. And I was like, yeah, no, I love that about my neighborhood. Like there's always like huge quinceañeras parties that we can hear the music. And there was a giant Diwali party somewhere that we could hear. You know, so like it's just, you know, to me, that is the beauty of living somewhere that is a mishmash of people.
Absolutely. And these little pieces of every culture slowly get integrated into the broader regional aspects of who we all are. So there's a time, I'm not sure what that point is or what the exact time frame is, in which it stops being this other that becomes appropriated and starts to become an everyday aspect of life that the community just becomes part of. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there are certain folk charms, especially these sort of counting out rhymes in childhood, that sort of reflect that. When you give it to children, when you give these ideas to children, you do strip away a certain level of ownership that you have when you pass things on to the next generation. It's sort of like the idea that art belongs to everybody. Once the artist puts it out there, yeah. It doesn't matter what they thought or what they wanted. It now belongs to the other 8 billion humans on this planet with us and nature itself. And in some ways, magical practice Sometimes it's like that. There are practices that are closed in which their practices are not open and known to us. And that's awesome. And then there are practices where it was going to get out, it got out, and now it's just part of it. So now we have witchcraft that's very, or magical practices and witchcraft that's very specific to New England, very Salem style, or very Louisiana style, or very Florida style. Wherever you're going in this country, versus Santa Fe style, which reflects who lived there, what they were practicing, dominant religions, superstitions, more social mores and customs. And they stop being for a specific group and start becoming just the fabric of what we are as this weird little experiment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's still like this perception in the U.S. at least. There seems to be this like very East part of the country centric when we talk about North American folk magic. We're talking about New England. We're talking about Appalachia. And we're talking about New Orleans. And there's right. like all these other places.
You're right.
Not to mention Mexico and Canada are also North America.
Right. You know? Right.
So, and yeah, like the Quebecois, like the whole French-Canadian
magic.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating folklore. So much more. And, you know, what I love about French-Canadian magic is I love how much more shape-shifting exists in that one. It sort of resonates with the magical practices I grew up with in the Southwest. So in California and in that area, there's a lot more shapeshifters, skin changers, skin walkers. The idea of transformation magic is really, really powerful. The idea that people who have power leave their skins or leave their bodies or transform entirely is really shared. And I just love that because those beliefs in the Southwest are mostly coming up from Mexico. So it's nice to be sandwiched between these wonderful shapeshifting beliefs.
Yeah. And I think about like French and like Breton and Celtic, like the Tamlin tales, like that kind of shifting with, you know, where it's kind of all blended with fairy and escaping the fae and all of that. And then Kelkies, and like, there's so much that things that did come over and things that didn't quite make the leap.
Right. But there's that connectivity where there's something that was so universal, it had to, like witches. Mm-hmm. Or ghosts, or my personal favorite after witches, mermaids. Mm-hmm. Every culture had their own half sea creature person, it seems. And so on any coast you go to in any town, no matter who's there, there's going to be some sort of mermaid story, sea monster story, some sort of Melusine, some sort of Naga, some sort of, you know, snake creature or sea woman or siren or
Or like the Vodny Volks in Russia, you know, like that's probably a mispronunciation and I apologize.
Or Rusalka, which is probably also not pronounced correctly. I don't know.
I always go between this thing of like, there does seem to be, like you said, this universality. And then I also don't want to erase like the individual things, the unique things. And because I think it's easy to kind of you know, doing a chalk painting and just kind of smear and blend all that in. And like, sometimes these things are distinct for a reason. And I don't think we should lose sight of that. But there do seem to be these things where things overlap.
Definitely.
At least. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this was such a great like little dive. Like I hope people can find this book. And I did want to say, and I put it out like on social media, although now that I'm not on Meta, my social media reach is kind of tiny. I'm rebuilding that slowly. So if you are listening, I'm no longer on Meta, but you can follow Witchlit on Blue Sky at Witchlit Pod. And then obviously we have our website, which is witchlitpod.com. But I did mention in the social media stuff that, and I think in the last episode, that this book is available in open library, so you can go to archive.org and check it out. I looked around on the internet because I was like, oh, I would really like to have a copy of this book, and it's pricey.
Yes.
Like the cheapest one I saw was about $60. So.
Yeah, I'm looking at my copy right here, and pretty sure my Grammy took it from a library at some point and just gently forgot to return it.
Yeah, the scanned copy at Open Library is a remainder from a library. So,
yep.
And the two of the copies I saw for sale were also remainders. So I think that's where they got preserved, probably.
Definitely.
But it is out there to purchase if you want to purchase it. And you can check it out from Open Library. And I recommend it. And now I kind of want to go look at some, I want to go look at the food one.
Yes. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. That one I really want to know about. And I really encourage people to, especially if you are a folk magician or a folk witch or a traditional witch or anyone who's really interested in history, just how familiar some of these charms will be, whether you're a practitioner or not, they're just really, honestly, no pun intended, but very charming.
Yeah, they are very charming.
They're sweet. And sometimes, especially right now, when the world seems just so complicated, there is an incredible comfort to be found in the simplicity of these little sorceries. And I'm a huge advocate for little sorceries. I've written a lot about the idea of little sorceries being a huge part of staying connected to seasons. That's what a lot of this magic is doing, is keeping us connected to the seasons as they turn, the flowers that are available, the birds you would see, the cold winter nights, you know, that connectivity, especially right now when there is a distinct feeling of a lack of community all around us, is so important. And these little sorceries are fun ones to share and to pass on to your kids and to your family and to just, hell, some of these I've done at parties. You know, we just had a lot of fun with them. I think it was last Beltane or last Imbolc. We incorporated some of these love charms that fit the season. And it was a huge hit to do with these folks who were not practitioners. They're just, you know, they're friends of my partners, you know, and it was just a great way to connect with people. And it started a conversation about what this book does, you know, on its own, which is starts a conversation about what you remember about being a kid and what was magical about it in the first place. And how do you preserve that magic now that you're an adult? Where does it fit in?
Yep. No, I love that. So before we wrap up, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of tell people like what you want to tell them, like where they can find your work, what you're working on. Blog away.
Absolutely. So y'all, unfortunately, I have not left the machine, so you can still find me on Instagram, but you can also find me on Threads and Blue Sky. Everything that I post on these places gets cross-posted over to Facebook, but I'm still keeping up www.viahedera.com, which is where I post articles and research, and a lot of the stuff that you heard today you'll find there, including some of the charms that were mentioned today. You can also find me in Llewellyn's 2025 calendar and date book. You'll find me, I am August in the calendar, which is a spell on brambleberry spirits and a bramble spirit vessel jar that you can make at home. Or you can find me in the 2025 date book where I discuss the magic of witch rabbits and rabbit witches. Right now, I'm just working on finishing up that book I've been working on forever and starting some new series of statues relating to very rare and erudite deities that we don't hear a lot about anymore.
Nice.
So that's been my main focus, and focusing on a seasonal Sabbath-based recipe book using recipes that can be found on my blog, including fried dandelions, pickled magnolias, and everything to help celebrate the season. So that's what I'm currently working on.
Yeah, and for folks who haven't seen Via's sculptures of her deity, they are so beautiful. So I can't wait to see more new ones. That's exciting. And I am super excited for the seasons book. Super
yes.
excited. Like, that is so in my wheelhouse.
Oh, I'm so excited. I've been trying out recipes and forcing them on my partner, and he's such a good sport.
Yeah. Yeah. I have been doing the same with my current book too. And I'm like, I'm glad y'all love me. Well, cool. Well, I hope things continue to go gangbusters for you. And I can't wait for this book to come out. Keep us posted.
Will do.
And for folks, I'll try and put as much as I can in the notes. I'm kind of limited on actual text and how much I can put in the show notes, but I'll put as much stuff as I can on the website. If you want to go find these things, I'll definitely include links to Via's website and her book and this book on Open Library. And but yeah, and if you enjoyed our conversation, please let us know. Spotify and Apple both let you leave reviews. And if you want to help us out, you can contribute to our Ko-fi, which is a link in the show notes because I can't remember the URL. But I just want to thank everybody for listening today. And Via, I want to thank you for coming back on. I feel like you are officially now a friend of the pod.
Yes, please. Anytime. Thank you, Victoria. And thank you for your patience.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, we had to reschedule multiple times because life intervened for both of us. So, but we finally made it happen. And I think on at a lovely time of year in May and, in, you know, with a lovely book that kind of just helps you enjoy the seasons and all that is going on now, despite all that is going on now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shanekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.